Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 2nd of November. If I only knew then, learning from our mistakes. Charles Grodin is joining us this hour, and that's the title of his book. It is interviews with his friends and also friends of friends. He's an actor, an author, a political commentator, and an activist, and the book has been described as jewels of wisdom from his friends and colleagues in the worlds of entertainment, sports, journalism, politics, and business. Interviews with Alan Alda on over-preparing for a much-anticipated interview with Carl Sagan. Interviews with Rosie O'Donnell, with Shirley MacLaine, with Carol Burnett, and her encounter with Cary Grant. It's a great story. Leonard Nimoy, Mario Cuomo, on advice that he gave that he wished he hadn't to Michael Dukakis. Charles is a recent recipient of the William Kunstler Award for Racial Justice, and the Help Hero Award for his humanitarian efforts on behalf of the homeless. He, of course, has an illustrious career in theater, in movies, as an actor in The Heartbreak Kid, Midnight Run, Beethoven. He's written 5 books, including It Would Be So Nice If You Weren't Here. All of the proceeds of this book will be donated to Help USA, which is a not-for-profit organization with a mission to empower the homeless and others in a quest to become and remain self-reliant. Grodin learned the acting craft under the guidance of Lee Strasberg and Uta Hagen before making his 1962 Broadway debut opposite Anthony Quinn. His first film appearance in Joseph Adler's Sex and the College Girl. He played the devilish obstetrician in Rosemary's Baby. He played the navigator in Mike Nichols' Catch-22. Elaine May, who was a mentor of his, we'll ask him about this, cast him in the lead of the Neil Simon scripted The Heartbreak Kid. He directed Broadway play Thieves and played the leading role in the film version. And he moved into the talk show realm in 1995. The Charles Grodin Show ran for several years on CNBC. He's currently a commentator for CBS News and was nominated for the New York Festival's 2007 Radio Broadcasting Lifetime Achievement Award. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Charles. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Or you can send us one of those emails at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Charles.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us.
I'm still back on that first quote you referenced, the jewel of something, had the word jewel in it.
Yeah.
What was the attribution of that? Who said that?
Beats me.
Is this a quote? Maybe the publicist said that. Who knows? I said a jewel. That's some quote. I hadn't heard that one.
Well, it's the truth, right?
Well, I think so.
Of course.
No, yeah. I think this is the most important project I've ever been involved with, because I've never really, with whatever I've done, I've never really felt that this is something that can actually alter a person's life. Because if you read these 82 essays, I would say maybe 75 or even maybe 7, a little bit more than that, are on of a serious vein, and they can broaden your awareness and make you think about things more, and maybe turn what ends up being hindsight when you look back on your life and the mistakes you made into foresight,
mm-hmm.
and avoiding making certain decisions that you wish you hadn't made. And the whole principle of this is whenever we've made mistakes, in my experience, you don't know you're making them, and it's only later you realize it. So if you can broaden your consciousness, it might help make a happier life for yourself. That's why I think the book has real value, and they're relatively, you know, 2 pages, something like that is the average of the essays, and you get a lot of wisdom from these people, and you might, as you read them and reflect on them, in fact, you know, I intend to study the book almost as like a textbook, and think, is there something in here, is there a lesson for me to learn, even though I've been working on it 2.5 years, can I still gain, and maybe I'm not living my life as intelligently as I could, even though that's on my mind all the time, maybe I can do better, and it comes out of studying these mistakes and hoping that I don't make them.
Yeah. Let's start with you in the book, and in your relationship with your father asking you to work for him in the store, and what you learned from that. I think it really touches the heart, your story.
I excuse me. I had begun kindergarten when I was 4 years old, and then I began the Hebrew school when I was 7 years old. And when I started high school, I really wanted to either play sports or eventually, maybe not right away, the idea of being in theater or plays, that came later. But I just wanted my free time after school. My father had a business, and he wanted me to come in after school and work in with the business. And I did, but not enough to his satisfaction. My older brother did, you know, all the time and did as he was asked to do. But it wasn't a question of money. You could, and he did, hire someone for 50 cents an hour at that time to do what he wanted me to do. And so it was a back-and-forth struggle between us, and he never felt that I had given enough, and I felt like, why am I being asked to do this? I really would like to be out on my own. And then because my father had been ill his whole life, even before he married my mother, I was so used to him being ill and in and out of hospitals, but he still worked all the time. If he wasn't in the hospital, he was working 7 days a week, and he had that kind of work ethic. And then, so in the middle of this struggle that reduced itself to us, even though we lived in a small six-room house, he wanted me to put any serious request for anything in writing. He didn't want to get into it with me, and I hold those letters. You know, I thought I made a very good case. It would be usually a request for the car on a date or something like that, and he wrote back why he just wasn't comfortable with that, at this and that, and he died when I was 18, and I didn't see it coming. It was quite a shock. So the lesson I learned, what I didn't realize at the time, it even if you don't agree with someone, if you love them as I loved my father, sometimes it's better not to prevail. And I just didn't have that kind of insight at that time. But looking back, I wish I hadn't prevailed. And so now in my relationship with my wife or my children, even if I think I'm right, I will not necessarily try to prevail because of the cost to them. And it's easier said than done, but it's something worth considering.
Yeah. Who told, I can't remember who told this story. There are a lot of them in the book. A lot of things happen to us in our teenage years, though,
yes.
Right? So we're
yes.
trying to establish who we are, and sometimes it's yes. in opposition to who our parents are. What's the story, though, of the young woman who was embarrassed, and all teenagers have felt this?
That's Mary Steenburgen driving in a car with her father.
Right.
And he had heart problems, and he worked for the railroad, and sometimes he couldn't work for a couple of years because of his illnesses, and eventually took a job with a company, and the company required that he put a sign on the back of his car, and then she realized that they were, you know, relatively poor, and she was in the car with him one day, and the popular boy in the high school was walking by. She saw him and didn't want him to see her in this kind of car with a sign on it, so she ducked down and pretended to have to tie her shoe, and she writes about, she could still remember her father saying, "Mary, you don't have to be ashamed to be in this car."
Right.
And it really touches your heart, and
right.
it's about values and about where we really should put our focus and what really is important. And she's lived that way. I've done the two movies with her, and she's quite an outstanding woman.
Yeah. It's amazing how many people had fairly difficult circumstances growing up. I mean, people who are big stars like you, people like Robert Redford, who's growing up was, you know, not an easy goal for him.
Yeah, he wasn't didn't come from any kind of means at all, a lot of jobs. He just, you know, he writes about always trying to be creative in these warehouse jobs and loading
right.
up dollies too much. And and then, you know, embarrassing his father, who probably got him the job, who I believe was an accountant, and, you know, causing all kinds of things to smash. But, you know, Robert Redford, who I met 47 years ago, you know, has conducted his life always trying to expand creatively. And he was even trying to do it at that time to kind of just deal with the boredom of the job. And it was interesting when I read that one, because I do a lot of those things too. I'll take something that is not that interesting, and I'll count how long would it take me to get there.
Right.
You know, and so I'll create these games for myself. When I worked with him 47 years ago, we both lived on the Upper West Side of New York, and one time I went over with him to his apartment, and we walked in. It was a one-room studio apartment, and he said to me, "You know, when I rented this place, I opened the closet door, and I realized, oh, it has a bedroom." So I wrote about that once, about that he, you know, that Robert Redford, you know, the sun was shining on him even then. Then another time I wrote a story called Robert Redford Stays, some, whatever they call them, travel agent booked me into a place. He sold me on staying there because the Robert Redford stayed there. And I figured, well, if Redford stayed there, it's probably a pretty good place. And then it turned out to have, I don't even want to, well, let's just say it was infested. And then I started to think, so when I say Robert Redford stayed there, maybe it's not the Robert Redford of the Sundance Film Institute, but it's the Robert Redford of Jeremiah Johnson, who's out there willing to be in the wilderness around, you know, wild animals. So you know, maybe I should have found a place that Cary Grant stayed. Robert Redford.
Oh, tell the Cary Grant story too. The Carol Burnett. You know,
oh, that's
somebody
so funny. And Carol told me that when you know she just couldn't handle meeting him, and she just could not do that, and didn't want to meet him, even though. And the reason was because she had been told he was a big fan of her variety show, and just felt that if he met her, you know, she would inevitably disappoint him, and try to get out of a party where he was heading toward her, and her husband said, "What's the matter with you? What are you doing?" And then there's Cary Grant holding her hand, and she later told me she literally could not. All she could do is see his eyes and his lips moving, but she couldn't hear one word he was saying because she was mesmerized. And then finally, when the time came for her to speak, to say something, the best she could come up with is, "You're a credit to your profession." and you know, so the lesson she learned is trust your instincts. She couldn't handle it. And I spoke to her about it afterward, and she said, "I really couldn't hear one word he said.
Oh, my gosh.
I was just so overwhelmed." So it's got some cute pieces in there like that, and the story of Sally Kellerman, who ends up spending a night with Marlon Brando. That's a very unusual story. But I would say the bulk of the stories are more of it, more serious and important lessons. Even as I talk to you right now, I'm thinking, you know, am I making the right choices today with exactly what am I going to do today? Am I spending my time most advantageously? And it's not something people think about very much. You just kind of go and do what you're doing. You don't really think. I mean, there's a number of essays in there about appreciate what you have.
Right.
And, you know, it's an axiom. I mean, you would say, well, of course, you know, you appreciate it. But do you? Do you appreciate what you have? Do you, in my case, you know, I'm blessed with unusually good health, remarkable, because everybody I know my age is dealing with sometimes serious problems. And for whatever reason, including my brother, who's older than I am, and, you know, do you appreciate, you know, I live in a very nice place, and I'm aware I don't appreciate the surroundings as much as someone else might, and it might be something I would benefit from working on. For example, this just happened recently. My wife bought this painting, and I was staring at it and looking at it, and I said, you know, I really, you know, to know this is not a print. This is an original piece of artwork. And for the first time, I appreciated that I was looking at an original piece, a beautiful piece of artwork. It's a seascape or something like that. And something was clicking in me that had never clicked before, an appreciation of, say, the art in museums or things. I've never been bent that way. So you just open up your consciousness and you think, what am I missing? What could I be doing better, since I can look back and list the number of mistakes that I made, and I absolutely, as today, and I believe this is true of everyone, I had no idea at the time this is a mistake.
Right.
No idea. And that could be happening right now to all of us. That's the real value of the book. It makes you think a little harder about what are you doing, what are you saying, and the ramifications of your actions and your words.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Charles. Charles Grodin is our guest, and his book is If I Only Knew Then, Learning from Our Mistakes. It's interviews with friends and friends of friends. Gene Wilder, Robert Redford, we've already talked about. Carol Burnett, Art Garfunkel, interesting story about him. Goldie Hawn, Walter Cronkite, Mario Cuomo, Alan Alda, and others. Lily Tomlin will be welcoming phone calls for him if you'd like to join us at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And then we have this email address, too, which is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. You may want to take on the central question of the book, certainly, is what you've learned from your mistakes as well. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're welcoming phone calls for Charles Grodin. His book is If I Only Knew Then, Learning from Our Mistakes. And our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Or feel free also to go to our email address, which is talk@WPR.org. And we start our calls with Scott from Milwaukee. Charles, hi, Scott.
Hi, I'm really enjoying the story so far and some of the anecdotes. It's always nice to personalize some of the people I see on screen.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, and you mentioned just before the break, maybe addressing the central question of the book, learning from our mistakes and things that we've learned. I guess one of the first things that came to my mind is one of the hardest things for me as I've grown up and grown older is learning how to forgive myself and not be limited by the things I've done in the past, looking at, you know, some of the things I've done thinking, oh, my God, that was so dumb, or looking at it and realizing that, you know, what I did had negative repercussions for me or maybe hurt someone else. And not just learning from that, but learning how to forgive myself and say, you know, I'm not going to judge myself. I'm not going to, you know, beat myself up about this and run around in mental and emotional circles and not be able to accept it. That's been is a burgeoning perfectionist. I'm sure there's a lot of other people who think the same way. They look at what they've done and have difficulties really accepting that they've made those mistakes.
Well, that's right. I agree with you, Scott. I don't walk around obsessing about these things. But, you know, one of the participants, the contributors of the book, was Judge Judy, who really didn't even want to acknowledge there were such things as mistakes. She really wanted to say that these are learning experiences. And I said to her, but, you know, Judy, you know, somebody's going to come up in front of your court for armed robbery, and you say, but Judge, it was just a learning experience. You said it. And she says, okay, I take your point. And then she called me back the next morning. She says, I couldn't sleep last night. I'd like the essay to stay as I said it. I said, it will stay as you said it. And you'll deal with it that way. But I agree. You learn from it. You try to do better. And if you didn't learn from it, I mean, that's the benefit of looking at your mistake and saying, I shouldn't have done that. I mean, I did many things because I just offered one mistake in the book, but I did many things that I regret. I just didn't have the awareness that this was not appropriate to do. And in my case, generally, they ran when I was younger. But I'm certain I've done it. I've made mistakes. I've made mistakes recently. I mean, I do a lot of hosting of charity events, and these events generally are very serious, and you cannot do. They usually get me there because they like, you know, me to bring some humor. But if, you know, the last one I did was for New York Hospital, the Children's Blood Center. Well, there's nothing humorous about it, so it's a real test. And a mistake that I made a couple of years ago that's gotten me banned locally in my area is I always hosted the Christmas show, and I introduced one of the amateur groups by saying the fact that you don't have to audition for this group should in no way reflect on the quality of the group. Well, the audience laughed, but the group, that was very insensitive of me. They really didn't appreciate that, even though I had earlier said I was fired when my first job as a singer. But they just didn't find that humorous, and I felt very bad about it, that I hurt their feelings. So you can make them very easily right today. I hope I can get through the rest of the day without, you know, because I joke around a lot, and sometimes if you don't know I'm joking, you know, I'll say to somebody, you know, didn't I see your picture in the post office? Well, one person looked up at me, and I might have said it to the wrong person. Maybe at one point their picture was in the post office.
Right.
I've discovered sometimes that's the bane of a dry sense of humor.
That's the problem.
That's right.
That's the problem. People think you completely, you know. Hope that they know you're joking, because I would never, you know, if I did recognize an escaped convict, I probably wouldn't directly approach that person.
Anything else, Scott?
No, thank you.
All right, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Dave from Augusta. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning, everybody. My question to Charles is, I've been a big fan of his for a long time, read a lot of his books. I was watching the Best of Johnny Carson last week, and I know that you appeared on the Johnny Carson show quite a bit. My question to you, Charles, is, was the relationship that you two showed on the air, was that just a show, or was that...
this has been one of the pains of my existence. I went on Johnny Carson in early 1973, and I almost immediately realized that this was overwhelming. I mean, you're there with a big band, 500 people waiting to scream at everything you say, and I just didn't feel equipped to deal with anything like that. So I established a character of somebody who was very kind of disgruntled, which I do to this day. I'll be on David Letterman on Thanksgiving, and I did it for years with Johnny Carson and with David Letterman. Of somebody who's just disgruntled. It's a kind of a character. And so Johnny Carson would say to me, so how are you feeling? How are you doing? And I'd say, well, I really can't answer that because I know you have no interest in my answer. And the audience would actually hiss me, not knowing that I was actually under contract to Johnny Carson as a guest. So he knew what I was doing. But a lot of people in the audience thought, well, he's a very rude, unpleasant person.
So to this day,
there's a number of people that think that I'm serious when I'm out there on those late night comedy shows. But there was a time where Johnny Carson said to me on the air, he says, you know, when I first met you, and he meant on the air, I wasn't quite sure what to do with you, and then I realized I can do anything. And then after he retired, he actually called and asked me to come out to have dinner with him and his wife. And that was really something. The three of us are out there, and I was starting my cable show. That was in 1995. And I was very surprised to hear or to learn at that dinner. He had absolutely no interest in show business whatsoever. He was much more interested in astronomy, going on safari, and actually asked me to join him on a safari. And I said, what, I'm going to sleep in a tent with you with wild animals trying to get in? You've got the wrong customer with this. But he was he was just a brilliant to do that for as long as he did it, just as David Letterman did it. And it always, frankly, just saddens me terribly that he ended up alone. I didn't know that. I think he was married two or three, maybe even four times. And I thought that the last marriage, the one where I knew his wife, I did not know that they had parted, and so his last period of life, not only was he dealing with emphysema, but he was alone. Hopefully, there were some friends out there, but he did not have, he couldn't sustain a relationship with his wives, and that just really saddened me, because here's someone who brought so much humor and laughter and goodwill and charm to us all, but evidently struggled mightily on the personal side, and I corresponded with him over the years. I once got a residual for being in these Best of Carson DVDs they put out, and it was for three appearances, and the check came to a total of $8 and something. So
I wrote him a
letter, and I said, I always felt, I like to think that I was a tiny part of the success of the Tonight Show. I just hadn't realized how tiny. And then he wrote me back and said, you know, he was glad that I brought it to his attention. He checked with bookkeeping, and there was an overpayment. it was a wonderful relationship, and mostly on the air. But I did have the opportunity that one time to have dinner with him. And I'm sorry I didn't. I actually spent a lot more time over the years with Jack Parr, his predecessor. And became very good friends with him right up to the end of his life, where Jack had a stroke and couldn't speak in the last year or so. And of all the people, to not be able to speak, because Jack loved to talk and was charming and witty and just a wonderful. And I always take it. I actually have it framed that I spoke at his service, and they had me as the last speaker after some pretty impressive people. And I think one of the most flattering things that was ever said to me, if I could be self-serving here, is his daughter said to me, "We don't think anyone can top you talking about Dad." But I'll give you a funny line. At the service was Andy Rooney, and I ended my talk by saying I had over the years become friends with Robert Kennedy's widow, Ethel Kennedy, and I'd spoken to her that afternoon, and she said that she felt that Jack Parr was up in heaven with Jack and Bobby. And I ended my speech with her permission, by quoting her, and Andy Rooney came over to me afterwards. He says, "I thought you were terrific, except for that last part," because he's more of an agnostic. And he didn't appreciate that. So Andy can find more things, but it's almost kind of funny. And I've been able to sustain a friendship with Andy Rooney, which is not, is definitely not the boy next door.
Thank you.
Thank you,
thanks, Dave.
Thank you
thanks
much.
For the call. So do you think do you ever think it was a mistake to not have gone on that safari with Johnny Carson?
No.
No.
I mean, I'm sure, after the fact, I probably would have enjoyed it. But I don't really like to go much of anywhere. I went so many places when I was doing movies, all mm-hmm. over the world that I don't know. I mean, I guess once you're there, it's all right. But I like where I live, and I don't really. And even at that time, I wasn't really. But you're probably right. I probably should have gone. It probably was a mistake. Now that you make me think about it more,
yeah,
it would have been what a memorable experience it would have been.
Well, you've had your share of memorable experiences. I wouldn't worry about
but
that.
But I won't. But I could see that. That definitely could qualify as a mistake.
Because we're so much into a political season and political ads, I found that chapter really interesting. Mario Cuomo's.
Yeah.
Mistake when it comes to Michael Dukakis.
Yeah, he advised him not to answer the negative attacks,
yeah.
and when he didn't, he was well ahead of the senior President Bush, and then he just plummeted because he never responded to these
mm-hmm.
really unfair negative attacks. He wasn't letting criminals. He had nothing to do with that. He wasn't polluting the harbor. All those ads that they ran had nothing to do with that. That wasn't under his control, and Mario Cuomo was, and Orrin Hatch is a senator from Utah, who's a friend of mine. He acknowledges that he made a mistake by voting against Martin Luther King Day because of the
yes.
symbolism of it all. He failed to see that what it represented to so many people. And I was just so pleased that he's a lovely man, that he would come forward and offer that, because a lot of people, I mean, one very well-known friend of mine, when I asked him to contribute, he just simply said, out of the question. Some people absolutely are not comfortable looking at or acknowledging mistakes. They feel it diminishes them. I feel it raises you up if you can look at something, acknowledge it, and say, I'm going to try to do better, because everyone does make mistakes.
Right. I think that he's been so gracious to us, Alan Alda, and I love interviewing him. But I love this story, and he talked during our interviews about how people think he's smarter than he actually is. And lo and behold, what does he write about but trying to appear really smart doing an interview with Carl Sagan? It's very revealing.
It is, I have a friend who does that in life, comes off as all knowing, and I love this guy, but that is a flaw. And I asked my wife, and I told Alan this story. I said, do you think it would be too aggressive to mail him Alan's essay about, and she said, yes, I do. I think it would be too aggressive to do that. But that's, when I was hosting a cable show, you don't want to come off as the all-knowing person or the expert. It's better to be the, I remember I once had Nancy Gibbs on, I think it was one of the editors of Time Magazine, and I asked her a question about give us some background on the Middle East, and she looked at me almost as though she would have expected that I would know that. Well, I did know some of it, but I like to ask the questions, like Chris Matthews will say, tell me something I don't know,
mm-hmm.
and I would prefer he say, tell us something the audience doesn't know. In other words, don't be, it gets too inside sometimes.
Right, right.
And don't make assumptions that we all know all these things. But Alan is Alan Auld and I have a unique relationship because I did a play on Broadway called Same Time Next Year, and he did the movie version. You almost never have the person who played it on Broadway and didn't play it in the movies be friends with the person who played the role in the movie. So I'm very proud that we are such good friends. In spite of that, I think it may be a first.
He just seems to be a real genuine person, and you do as well, so I can see how you would be friends.
Well, he's a lovely person, and he's you know, what I'm interested in and is something that he's very interested in. He's a Help USA is a kind of a sister organization to Mentoring USA, and he's very involved in Mentoring USA. So I'm very impressed with anyone who tries to help others, and Alan Auld is one of those people, just as Regis Philbin is as well. And it has something to do with why we're all friends. It's important to me that if you're in a position to help, that you do that, because anyone who can do that, I'm sure, learns that the best thing you can do for yourself is to reach out and to try to help somebody else.
And you start the book, I think, with Regis Philbin. Tell us that story.
Well, Regis Philbin was a very big hit in a local talk show in San Diego, and that led to him getting a national show replacing the icon Steve Allen. And he was so overwhelmed and so not confident about himself that when he went on the national scene, instead of doing what he does and what he did in San Diego and what he does today, just kind of chats about what's been going on with him, he decided there were all these writers and he was reading jokes off cue cards, and the show didn't work. And his point was, you know, go with what got you there and don't let people take you away from your strength. He is maybe, I can't think of anyone I'd rather spend time with than Regis Philbin.
Really?
We had dinner Saturday night, and I'm what they call a bitmeister. I fool around a lot, not only in the late night television, but in life. I can only go a certain amount of time without trying to do some kind of a. So he had told me, like 3 or 4 days before our Saturday night dinner, how much he was enjoying the audio tape of the book that I read along with my daughter, who's a professional stand-up comedian. She reads the women's essay, and he was enjoying it. And I said, I don't have it. I've never heard it. I don't have it. So as a joke, I wrote a draft, and I had a lawyer write a letter where I was suing him for damages, invasion of privacy, that, you know, and the judicial code. It was all a joke.
Yeah.
I hand him the letter, and, you know, and he kept a copy of it. That was the fun part. But he knew that was a joke. What he didn't know was a joke is that I had arranged for the owner of the restaurant, because in one of the rooms there's somebody playing a piano, to come over to him. It was my wife and Regis and Joy Philbin, and the four of us, and the owner of the restaurant came over as arranged by me before. And it said, "Mr. Philbin, excuse me, if you'd be comfortable getting up and doing a couple of numbers, we'd be happy to get the check. And Mrs. Philbin, if you'd like to join your husband, there's a takeout on us as well." Well, it took a little while before he realized there was his friend Chuck Grodin doing another bit on him, because he really thought this was a genuine offer. You could see his little face look up there. "You're asking me to get up and sing." So it's fun. I mean, you know, that's kind of the whole point of it.
It's nice that you worked with your daughter on an audio tape. I didn't know you had done that.
You say it again, the what?
Yeah, working with your daughter on the audio tape?
That's
great.
Because I didn't think, you know, they wanted me to do the essays. And I said, well, I think a woman should read the women's essays. And my daughter, and I was listening to it the other day, and I called her and I said, "Well, you're a lot better than I am. I mean, you really are good at this, you know." And she's a very successful stand-up comedian. She opened recently on Broadway for Linda Ronstadt.
Ah.
Yeah, so she's quite good, and she's going to be working with Help USA as well and helping the homeless. And until recently, she was working at a shelter in Harlem, the only Caucasian person there. Mm. So I'm very proud of her. This is difficult. These are difficult tasks. You're dealing with the enormous amounts of dysfunction and people with real problems and issues, and really without the capacities to deal with them. I mean, I once was at a dinner party with a group of people, and they were saying they're very conservative, and didn't really have any sympathy. One fellow said, I don't have any sympathy for African-Americans, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I was just silent. And then the hostess said, because I had a cable show at the time, it said, Chuck, you must have something to say. And I was afraid if I spoke, it would bring the dinner party to an abrupt halt.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, I'm a Caucasian. I had a mother and father at home. I had an older brother. I had role models. There were no drugs and crime around me. We weren't rich, but we weren't poor. I really didn't have to worry about anything. And I have found life to be extremely difficult. It is extremely difficult, the things that you have to deal with. And I have that with all my advantages. And I was just reading a piece in the U.S. News and World Report, an editorial by Mort Zuckerman yesterday, and I forget the percentage of single mothers in the black community, but it's extremely high. It could be, I have it around here somewhere, I don't want to misstate, but it's over 50%, it may be 70%. So you have all these African-American kids coming from single-parent homes, very high dropout rate in high school, not really qualified to for any kind of job where you make a living. And that's the most of our prison population are people of color, because the opportunities aren't there, and they do come from disadvantaged situations. So this host heard me say all that, and he stuck to his position. He says, well, you know, this idea you're supposed to lift yourself up by your own bootstraps. Of course, the answer to that is, what if you don't have boots? So I ran into him a few years after that, and he had been laid off his job. And he looked at me and said, you know, I see things completely differently. I see it more the way you were describing it that evening, because he was now in that position.
Walk a mile in my shoes, right?
Yeah.
We're going to welcome more phone calls. Charles Grodin is our guest. His book is If I Only Knew Then, Learning from Our Mistakes, interviews with friends and friends of friends about what they've learned from their mistakes in life. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send us an email, you could do that as well at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Grodin is our guest, and his book is If I Only Knew Then, Learning from Our Mistakes. If you'd like to join us, it's 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Tell me a little bit about somebody's described Elaine May as one of your mentors, and I know that you appeared in Catch-22 as well. Tell me about that relationship. I just think that the two of them are masters of timing and comedy, and yes. I listen to them a lot.
Well, you know, a lot of opportunities, a lot of the success for people comes because someone gave them an opportunity. And I, you know, I studied acting for 10 years, and there were many, many, many extremely gifted people in these various places, the Lee Strasberg, Uta Hagen, and places like that, that I never saw anywhere, not on television, not in the movies, I never saw them. They never had an opportunity.
Yes, right.
And it was around 1968 where I first ran into Elaine May, because she was friends with Renee Taylor, and I was directing a Broadway show called Lovers and Other Strangers, and I got to know her a little bit then. And I was directing them in something for public broadcasting, and as I was doing it, I said to they were it was a couple in bed together, and I looked at Joe Bologna, who had at that time also directed commercials, and I said, actually, I think you should be directing this, and I should be playing that role. And he said, well, we wrote it for you. So I get in the bed, and he directed, and Elaine May saw it, and she said, you know, they're asking me to direct movies now, and the first one I do, where there's something for you, I'm going to do that. And so that's how my opportunity came to be in The Heartbreak Kid. But if she hadn't, spotted that, seen me, because they could have, generally speaking, movies that are, they're star vehicles, that wouldn't have happened, and I might not have gone on, to be in movies, because she opened that door. She also saw me in prior to that in Catch-22 and thought there was something a little mad about me, and so I benefited from Mike Nichols casting me in that as well.
Is there something a little mad about you?
Probably, but it would only be in the this obsession with. I have two obsessions. One is to be useful, and the other is for humor.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have kind of I'm kind of driven to achieve something, and that can be as I've said many times, that could be just going shopping for my wife, picking up groceries. It doesn't have to be writing another book or a play or a movie or appearing or something like. I have that kind of drive to achieve, to do something, to just use. I'm not comfortable looking out the window. So if that, that's kind of unusual, but that, I don't think beyond that and this kind of obsession with kidding around and fooling around, I'll go into, I have about six places locally that I visit, there's a delicatessen, different shops, this and that, and, I'll go in there and do jokes, like there'll be a bald man with like two straight little pieces of hair in the front, and I'll do the joke. You cannot tell that is a hairpiece. Just can't see the lace, and everyone's looking around, So I enjoy fooling around a lot, and it's okay unless you live with me. If you live with me, it's rougher, because who needs to be with somebody fooling around a lot?
Yeah,
it can get to be. I always say to people who like to hang around with me, say, keep it like that. It's different if you're living with me, because I'm always like that.
But you use this word, and I think that we could use more of this, all of us in our lives. You want to be useful, and the word helpful. It's a good thing to be a helpful person.
If you can find a way, there are many people that would like to do it. And I remember first, I visited with Cesar Chavez way back in the late 60s.
Oh.
And I remember, him saying, reach out to help other people. And if you can do it, I don't know what everyone feels in their heart, but there's nothing as satisfying to me. I mean, I think. Well, I'd say this book has the greatest value of anything I did, because I think it will resonate with so many people and their lessons. But prior to that, somewhere around the year 2000, I was actually able, when I was doing my cable show, I took a camera, because I was made aware of certain cases, criminal cases, took a camera up to a woman's prison in Bedford, New York, and interviewed four women. Who I felt shouldn't be in prison, and I took the video, and we arranged a luncheon in the state capitol in Albany, New York, and I showed the video to the leadership, which is still the current leadership, all Republicans, and Joe Bruno. All he said was, "I agree with you," and all four of these women were granted clemency.
Oh my!
Because the right people were looking at these cases, and when you saw the cases, you said, these people should not be in prison. I'll give you one example of the prime one was a woman on welfare in Harlem in her early 20s with four children, had $5. She had no criminal record. She wasn't a drug dealer, nothing like that. And someone connected to the police set her up. They waved $2,500 in front of her face, and they arranged for her to carry. She jumped at it, to just carry a package of cocaine up to Albany. And they arrested her, and they sentenced her to 20 years to life. This is not illegal. You can do a police sting on someone who's just a poor person on welfare. I can understand doing it on a drug dealer, but this was not a drug dealer.
Mm-hmm.
And she spent 16 years before Governor Pataki got the clemency for her. So I think that those four women, getting out, it was a huge thing to me. I consider it my biggest accomplishment. And if this book is what I believe it is, and I already am getting enough feedback to suggest that it is, that it will resonate with people, it will broaden their awareness, it will give them a chance to be more constructive with how they use their time, and maybe to even be more helpful. There's just a lot of wisdom from a lot of bright people in this book.
Yeah. There sure is. Walter Cronkite. I still miss Walter Cronkite, tell you. I just loved – there'll never be anybody who can fill his shoes as far as I'm concerned.
He just ran radiated integrity.
Right, right. And he had an interesting thing. He retired too soon.
Yeah,
he did.
Yeah, he really, you know, some people really feel, I mean, he, you know, he said, if I'd have known, I think Walter Cronkite is in his early 90s now.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, you know, that was 25, over 25 years ago. And he just didn't, I think he said, if I knew I was going to live this long, I wouldn't have retired. I, you know, personally, I would never retire, you know, because I'm only interested in doing things. And I'm just not the kind of person that's going to like to just sit, you know, as lovely it is, as it is, and the respect I have for those who do get enjoyment, I have to do something. I wouldn't want to look out the window. I wouldn't want to be on a boat for a long period of time. And it's just a choice he made that he regrets. And I think, you know, one of the reviewers, I said, you know, what lesson can we take from that? Well, I think there's a very good lesson. You think long and hard before you retire.
Mm-hmm.
Know what you're getting into, and what are you going to do with your time?
Right.
You know, so, I mean, I think there's an important lesson. You know, some of them are just plain fun, but that's about four or five of them out of the 82. But you know, well over, like, 75 of them really have things that you could reflect on. I think the one that got me the most in the book was from Erwin Redlener, the doctor who was the co-founder of the Children's Health Fund with Paul Simon, when he talked about he was estranged from his son because his son had moved out to the West Coast of skiing, and he just couldn't believe that the love of his life really was going to be, this was going to be a permanent thing. He got married and he's out there. And their conversations on the phone were tense, and finally Erwin just decided he was just going to go out there and visit him, and they had this reconciliation, and it was wonderful. And then within the year, the boy died in a skiing accident.
Oh my gosh!
So I found that one I couldn't even. And his point was, don't let with a real loved one, don't let an estrangement
mm-hmm.
last. Because you don't know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And if he hadn't had the reconciliation, I mean, it's still overwhelmingly painful. I'd never met his son, but I can barely speak about it. So you can imagine how heartbreaking it all is. I have a friend, my friend Shelley Schultz, who's also a contributor to the book. I like his the lesson he learned. It's just a brief one-page thing. He says, live your life in such a way so the preacher doesn't have to bullshit the people.
That's good.
So I thought that was a good one, too, that they can actually get up and speak about you, you know, in a truthful way.
Right.
And this man, Shelley Schultz, who's just been very nice to me and to my daughter over the years, I got a phone call from his office about 2 months ago. And it was such a sober tone from his secretary, I really thought he had passed away. And it turned out his daughter had drowned at the age of 25.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so, I mean, you just don't know what life will bring. So you really do want to cherish, because we just, you know, we live our lives, we make the assumption that mm-hmm. everything is forever, and it isn't. And mm-hmm. you do want to make sure that you're not, that you're doing the best you can, and that you do want to consider what you do and what you say.
Yeah, we don't live with the thought that it could end, do we? When you talk about estrangement.
It's because it's too difficult to do that, and I understand that. But on the other hand, you do want to give thought to your actions and your behavior, because mm-hmm. there are ramifications. I mean, you know, as much as I talk about it and live it and always really, way before this book, I've always been focused like that. You know, I continually might say something that, you know, I was on the phone with a sports writer the other day, and I called him and I said, you know, I always like it when, I told my wife this story, she said, I said, I always like it when someone is smarter than me. I was watching a football game and the announcer said something I thought was very clever. And then this sports writer wrote about it and showed that it was inappropriate. And I didn't see the point. He had a better insight than I did.
Hmm.
And I told the story to my wife, and she said, "I think the way you told that seems to suggest that you think that you're smarter than other people." I said, "Well, that's not what I mean." She said, "That's what that sounds like. I like it when someone's smarter. What I really should have said is that was a wonderful insight."
Hmm.
And she said, "Keep yourself out of the equation." I would not have known that. So I made a mistake. She felt that it was like saying, I always assume I'm smarter, which is not true at all. That's not what I assume at all. But she said that's how that could sound. Now, that may not be true, but it's worth considering.
Yeah, it sure
is. I'm going to watch my words more carefully just based on that, because I had no idea I might be saying something in an inappropriate way.
Charles, thank you so much for being with us this hour. I really appreciate your time.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much.
Yeah, our pleasure. Charles Grodin, the book is If I Only Knew Then, Learning from Our Mistakes. It's interviews with friends and friends of friends. And it's he says that he could never understand people who look back on their lives and say, I wouldn't change a thing. The stories are, some of them are heartbreaking. They're all, he believes, very compelling. And the idea for the book came from an understanding of how important it is to identify our mistakes and then to learn from them and not repeat them. The book has just been published, we thank him for his time. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and to Rhonda Fanning as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll have news coming up and then many hours of great conversation ahead, so stay with us. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute before 11, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.